I'm Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We have been observing, a little belatedly, admittedly, Transgender Day of Visibility, which happened this past Sunday. I queued up right before the break the fact that a guy by the name of Michael Schellenberger is basically a big fat liar when it comes to issues surrounding transgender folks, the LGBTQIA community, as well as transgendered care. He put out a big fat lie in what he called the WPATH files about Nazis and transgender care. Anya and I are going to be debunking that at some length. You're not going to want to miss that. We'll get to that at the bottom of the hour, so stay tuned for that. Right now, I am going to be joined by friend of the show, friend of civic media, an expert on almost everything public policy in the state of Wisconsin, Mr. Rob Henkin, the executive director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, Maggie. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Happy post-election. Good to get another one under our belt. Every time they go off without a hitch, I think this is good. See, it's working just fine.
Absolutely.
I also thought one of the things that worked just fine in terms of our election functioning was, albeit an incredibly narrow outcome, the MPS funding referendum, which you talked about on the show a few weeks back, that was passed and adopted by a very thin margin. It was basically just a hair under 2,000 votes, I think, at the last count that I saw, with about 42,000 votes in favor of the funding referendum, more or less 51%, and just under 40,000 votes against the referendum, about 49% of voters. Did the outcome surprise you? Did how close it was surprise you? What were your thoughts seeing the outcome of the MPS referendum question?
Yep. First of all, Maggie, my typical qualifier here. We do not take a position at the forum, and we were neither pro nor con. I guess what we were pro was for voters really understanding the consequences and the facts behind this. I'm not often right, but actually when people ask me in the days leading up for a prediction, I predicted that it would narrowly squeak by. So I was not surprised at the outcome. I think there was a lot of feeling when the referendum was announced from people that I was talking to. Given the fact that it had passed with, I think, 75% of the vote, the previous referendum was approved in 2020, that this would be approved with a pretty wide margin. I personally didn't think that would be the case this time, just because it was only 4 years since the last one, and this was a much bigger ask of voters. The other much different factor here was that there was organized opposition this year. But ultimately, the supporters of providing this extra revenue capacity for the district prevailed.
Were you surprised at all, Rob, to see the opposition from the MMAC? So one of the organized opposition forces was coming from the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce. They spent a decent amount of money, just shy of about $500,000, opposing the referendum. Did that surprise you at all? And again, I want to reemphasize what Rob said at the top of the show, the Wisconsin Policy Forum and Rob himself, nonpartisan. They don't pick sides. They don't pick winners and losers. They are observers of these policy debates, and they help provide information to help us all be better voters. Were you surprised by the MMAC's opposition and I guess sort of the volume of the opposition, the intensity of it, the spend on it?
Yeah. So, you know, I can't comment on my surprise. What I can comment on is, you know, this was really nuanced. And in my own personal opinion, as Rob Henkin, private citizen, you know, it's unfair to say that if you opposed this particular referendum, that you're anti-public school or anti-Milwaukee youth. This one was tough in my estimation because, again, of the size of the request. And what I heard MMAC saying, and again, I don't want to put words in their mouths, was concern with the dollar figure, the $252 million. And then this was somewhat mischaracterized by MMAC and others. Not all of that is going to fall on the property taxpayer. About $127 right. million of that, after 4 years, as this is gradually phased in, MPS gets an extra $252 million of revenue authority above whatever the caps are, the state revenue limits are at that time. And roughly $127 million of that will come from property taxpayers. But because MPS will be spending more, that works favorably with the state school aids formula. So part of that will be school aid. So you're investing a very healthy chunk of property tax resources to buy down an extra infusion of state aids. And so many could argue that's a pretty good deal. But nevertheless, even at $127 million, I think what I heard MPS saying was, we don't see the justification for that big an ask of property taxpayers. We're not saying that MPS shouldn't get some additional dollars. Our concern is with that much. And again, there's a lot of subjectivity to a question like that. I think even if that is your position, you need to then answer the question, okay, but if this goes down, what's next? I mean, there can't possibly be another referendum. So right. if the feeling was, let them come back with a more reasonable ask in November, well, they need to pass a budget for 2025, a tentative budget in May, and then a permanent budget in September or October. So a host of questions there. Bottom line, this was not an easy call, I think, from anyone's perspective.
Yeah, and just again, to put in context, and you misspoke slightly, Rob, when you were explaining MMAC's, not MPS's, opposition to the referendum. Oh, I think you slipped in an MPS there just to be sure everybody understands. Yep. Again, the referendum was seeking a $252 million infusion of cash that stepped in over a number of years. There is a property tax increase component of it, but it's not the full load of the $252 million. That was what was passed. What was facing the school system, MPS, on the other side, had the referendum failed, was what MPS said would be around a 13% cut in its budget. Now, how exactly that would get allocated, what exactly that means, if you want to hear about what that might have looked like, you can look up the last time I talked with Rob a bit about this in some detail a couple of weeks back on the show. You can find those old shows at civicmedia.us. But it wasn't just MPS that was looking at a funding referendum in the state of Wisconsin. There are about 100 school districts across the state of Wisconsin that had funding referendums that this year, which is a big number. What's going on, Rob? Why is it that we're seeing basically almost every election cycle, or at least every year or so, literally tens, sometimes now over 100 school districts and other public service functions, including public safety, coming to voters with referendums? What's driving that?
Yep. So, you know, I really think there needs to be more focus on this symptom of a much larger issue, which we've talked about when I've been on this show in the past. The way that we are financing our local governments and our school districts needs to be reconsidered. Does that mean it needs to be completely overturned? Maybe or maybe not. But it has become anachronistic. And again, the measure of that is that we are seeing an increasing number of referenda, as you said, not only among school districts, but among municipal and county governments with each passing election cycle. And this is happening in blue parts of the state as well as in red parts of the state. It's happening both because of a need to address capital needs and a need to address operating needs. And it is a symptom of a structure that has been in place for many decades that is really starting to spring leaks. And so it just needs some thoughtful rethinking. And, you know, there may be a train of thought that this is the way it should work, that there should be strict limitations set by the state on the ability of local governments and school districts to generate revenues, and that if voters want to exceed those, then they should vote on it. But there are also problems with that type of approach. And there are also consequences, because what if the voters say no, and do we want to, you know, haves and have-nots throughout the state in terms of service levels for both education and critical public safety and other services? So big, big questions here.
Yeah, it bears noting that according to MPS, had state lawmakers raised caps on school funding simply to keep up with inflation, and this isn't a problem unique to Milwaukee public schools, it's statewide, but for Milwaukee public schools, simply to keep up with inflation over the last 15 years, the district would be getting, this number probably isn't totally accidental, around $210 million more from the state general fund every year. That is a huge number when you think about it on a cumulative basis year over year. And granted, MPS, largest school system, public school system in the state, but problems of that same type at different scales, depending on the size of the school system, are happening all across the state. I think that this is, it's an interesting moment to be observing this, right? Because we've seen within state government, there's a very large surplus. There have been proposals for extraordinarily generous tax refunds and tax cuts. And to me, it seems like it causes me a lot of cognitive dissonance, Rob, that at the state level, they're talking about cutting taxes and tax refunds, especially coming from the right side of the aisle, where we at the same time are observing in local government, again, in red counties and red cities, as well as blue ones, these incredible funding crunches to provide what most of us, regardless of party, think are essential government services, a good public school system and good public safety funding. We're going to dig into a little bit about what's going on there. What's the disconnect? When we come back, I've been joined this half hour by Rob Henken, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We're talking about local government funding statewide and the fact that we see referendums basically every election cycle now. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. If you've got a question for Rob or I, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. Back with more in just a moment. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. If you'd like to join our conversation, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. I'm joined this half hour by the executive director of the nonpartisan think tank, the Wisconsin Policy Forum. It helps each and every one of us across the state become more informed voters when we go into our polling places. On the ballot this last cycle was a $250 million referendum to help fund Milwaukee public schools, but it is not the only one of its kind. There were 102 school districts that had funding referendums on the ballot this year, which speaks to this sort of cognitive dissonance, Rob, that I think a lot of folks, including myself, are having. We've got these huge surpluses in the state budget. What's the surplus at right now, Rob?
We're actually coming out with a report on this next week, sizing up the state's fiscal condition. The state has about $1.8 billion, as I recall, in its rainy day fund, and has a general fund balance in excess of $6 billion. This current state budget will spend that down by about $3 billion, but still a healthy amount left over.
Yeah, you're talking about nearly $8 billion in effectively surplus dollars. And for folks that may have missed our prior discussions, how do we end up in this place where local governments, not just in our largest cities, but across the state, are struggling to keep their public school systems adequately funded to fund public safety at the local level while the state's sitting on a pot of gold? How do we get here?
Yep. Well, we got here because we've set up a structure where we very specifically have decided to give little taxing authority to local governments outside of the property tax. The state reserves that power for itself. The state instead says, use the property tax, and we're going to have a robust program of revenue sharing so that the sales and income taxes that we, the state, collect, get some portion of that gets shared with our local units of government. And what has happened over time is that the state has then put very strict limitations on the ability of local governments, number one, to raise their property taxes from year to year, and number two, the shared revenue program has essentially, prior to the adoption of Wisconsin Act 12 this past summer, has become a budget appropriation as opposed to a form of revenue sharing. And so it has stayed the same, not even increasing a dime for inflation for more than two decades.
Which is incredible. Let's just pause. I want to unpack that because there's some technical stuff there. In theory, I don't have an objection, or I feel pretty neutral about placing limits on local governments when it comes to revenue raising. But it rests upon effectively a social contract with state government that, through what we term here in the state of Wisconsin's shared revenue, that funding will go from the state to local governments in some meaningful proportion that is in part driven by population, by other metrics, as well as inflation, to meaningfully help fund the cost of baseline services in local government. And what Rob just said is that shared revenue up until very recently had not been increased for over two decades. So if you think about just the cost of inflation for all of us as just regular households and how much of a pinch, put that inflation in your mind over 20 years. Wow, that's extraordinary. And so at the base of this, to me, Rob, and this is my editorial, this isn't Rob's opinion, what you had was, frankly, a breach of the social contract between the state and local governments. And we don't sit as citizens as, oh, when I'm today, I'm just a resident of the state of Wisconsin, and isn't that great that we have a surplus? But tomorrow, I'm just a resident of the city of Rhinelander. We exist as both all the time. And it's also worthy of mention, in my opinion, that many local governments are given what wonks will refer to as mandated services, where the state will say, you have to provide this service to your citizens and residents. But often those are what we call, quote, unfunded mandates. In other words, they tell you to go do something, but they don't give you the funding. When you couple that with this freeze on shared revenue that doesn't even keep up with inflation for over 20 years, boy, doesn't paint a good picture. Is there a solution in the offing, Rob? What should we be looking to our state and local leaders to make this better for everybody in the state of Wisconsin?
So again, a very big part of the solution, the good news is, was adopted this past summer. And so there is a new extra layer to the shared revenue program so that the entire program is now linked to state sales tax collections. And that was the original intent. This is revenue sharing. So as state sales tax collections grow, 1/5 of that 5 cents state sales tax, the revenues generated by one penny of those 5 cents, will be sent back to local governments. So that will help. Will it erode more than 20 years of no inflationary increases? It depends which municipality or county you are. It depends whether you're, the perverse irony here is that if you are a growing municipality or county, you did have the ability to increase your property taxes more, and you're probably in better shape. It's the communities that are not growing that really need to invest in certain services and programs and roads and infrastructure to start to try to grow, right, that are really behind the eight ball here. So the jury is out as to whether this new mechanism will solve the problem.
Well, and there's, you know, lurking beneath all of this, again, my editorial, not Rob's, is sometimes dog whistled, but sometimes not so dog whistled bit of racial politics and sort of leaning into the urban rural divide. And I hate that because it's a completely bogus division that is sowed. it's hurt. People are hurting in our rural communities and our rural school systems, sometimes to a greater level of acuteness than we are in MPS. Large school systems, to some extent, can manage in their large budgets to sort of plug holes and MacGyver their way through tough times. Whereas if you're in a smaller rural school district, your public schools may be in very dire straits because of these same problems. Rob, what do you think is going to be the biggest question coming up in this next fiscal year, so looking to 2025 for local governments?
I think certainly the extent to which the extra dollars they are now being afforded are covering, in particular, the increased costs associated with public safety services. That's for local governments. I think for school districts, there was what sounded like a very generous increase in the revenue limit this as part of the state budget, but most are finding that wasn't nearly enough.
So we're going to have to revisit this issue until we get it right. Thanks so much for your time this afternoon. That's Rob Henken, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Look for the new report coming out on the state budget and the state surplus next week from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Rob will be back with us in 3 more weeks, regular guest of the show. Thanks again, Rob.
Thanks again for having me.
Of course, Ani and I will be back revisiting some of the damn lies told by Michael Schellenberger about the LGBTQIA community. And you're not going to want to miss it. After these short messages and your farm update here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esper. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We have been celebrated belatedly Transgender Day of Visibility. Before we get back to that topic, first, my thanks to Rob Henken, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, talking with us a bit about the continued crisis of local government funding that is going on statewide. Doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican. Every local government, it seems like, in the state of Wisconsin hasn't quite had the fiscal boom or boon, depending on your pinch off or B words this afternoon, that the state has, sitting on nearly $8 billion in surplus dollars. I don't think I've heard about a local government with a surplus in a long time. Again, thanks to Rob. He'll be back again in 3 weeks joining the Maggie Dawn Show on the regular. Look for the WPF's report coming out next week on the state budget and its enormous surplus and how that may or may not be spent. But I wanted to get back to some of the lies that have been propagated, the false hysteria, ginned up over and over and over again on the right. When it comes to the LGBTQIA plus community and especially trans folks, a frequent flyer offender in this milieu is Michael Schellenberger. He put out what's called the WPATH files, which is supposed to show that the World Professional Association for Transgender Health is just all full of hot air. But again, like much of this stuff, it's just a gaslight. In other words, or perhaps projection, maybe projection's the better term, because it's, you know, Schellenberger claims that WPATH is making stuff up and lying to folks, but it is Schellenberger that's doing that, not the WPATH. And what I've found probably most offensive of all of Schellenberger's lies about WPATH was his assertion that trans care was a Nazi invention. I mean, give me a... I just want to smell test this with you, Anya. Like, if you only had what you learned in grade school and high school about the Nazis, it would not seem to me that they'd be persecuting Jewish folks and Catholics and gypsies, but then supporting transgender care. I don't think that's really how Nazism worked.
No, you'd have to have such a deep fundamental misunderstanding of the idea that, like, the Nazis were doing awful so-called medical experimentation involving reproduction, but this is not at all the same as what we're talking about when we talk about trans healthcare. And it should be stated really, really clearly that trans healthcare, not just in the world, but in Germany specifically, trans healthcare predates the Nazi party. So the inherent lie that, oh, the Nazis invented it. No, the Nazi party does not become established until later on. Clear evidence of this we can talk about. Or sorry, did you?
No, go ahead.
Okay, sorry, I thought you'd... clear evidence of this exists in the fact that from 1919 to 1933, there was an institute in Berlin. In German, it was called the Institut für Sexualwissenschaft, or in English, the Institute for Sexual Sciences, or sexology, essentially. And again, this is during the existence of the Weimar Republic, after World War I, but before World War II. And this institute is, among many things, providing research and treatment for people who are trans at this period of time.
Yes, and it was burnt down by the Nazis.
It was burnt down. Its library was raided during the book burnings. Some of, like, the last photographical evidence we have of research that was written down there is in the photos of Nazis ripping them off the wall and burning them. It's a horrifying statement. And I should say too that this institute provided other things. They provided counseling for alcoholism. They provided testing for venereal diseases and contraception. It almost sounds like a certain other organization we might know who provides a lot of community support, but let's tear it down because it does this one other thing that we maybe disagree with in theory. But that's just an Anya take. So,
well, right. It's like the conservative attacks on Planned Parenthood, that we can call it out really specifically. Right. Yeah. And abortion services, which is a woman's choice to control her own healthcare, again, healthcare decision making. But also provided all kinds of critical medical services to women who are under or uninsured, right? Including contraception, mother wellness exams during, if someone wants to remain pregnant, they provided those sorts of services, mammograms, your annual women's wellness exam. I mean, very similar. But to return, here is Michael Schellenberger telling people what he knows is a lie. He's telling people that the Nazis invented trans care. No, they burned the place down that existed since 1919, that engaged in helping people and trying to have some degree of independent, objective medical assistance and study and research about these things. Yeah, the Nazis burned that down. I don't know of a lie that is as dangerous as something like that, right? Oh, no. Transgender care, yeah, invented by the Nazis. And then rinse, wash, repeat. You know, my parents used to say to me, like, a lie doesn't become true by the number of times you say it or the loudness with which you say it. But it seems to me that so many folks have simply forgotten that adage. And if they hear something enough, it becomes true for them. But that's not the way it works. And this is just an example of how important it is, especially if you only get your news from one source. to go ahead and like, don't get your news from Twitter. Don't get your news from TikTok. That is not news. Those aren't facts. To take the time to check the sources. I mean, you don't need a set of encyclopedias at home anymore. You have the internet at your fingertips. You can spend some time going through the sources, clicking on reference notes. If you see something without reference notes, just assume it's not accurate. Right? Like we try on this show, Anya's a great help to me. I try to provide it, you know, case names, dates. Here's when this person said this thing. You can go find it for yourself. And the people that are spewing this hate and separation don't seem to be concerned about that. They ain't fact checking. So shame on you, Michael Schellenberger. This is just, and again, it's all part of a whole, right? We talked yesterday about this stuff, the lies and the calling Democrats a satanic cult and calling people demons and lying about Easter to scare Christians. It's all of a piece. Oh, and here now we see the application of that when it comes to the LGBTQIA community. It's all the same tactic. If you can't win on morality, you make it up. If you can't win on constitutionality and American values, you make it up. You lie about it. If you can't win on science, you hire some hacks that don't know a damn thing about what they're talking about and can be, you know, sold to the highest bidder to make up the science. And you lie about it and you just repeat the lies over and over again. Karina, nice to see you on my board. Welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. What do you have to say this afternoon?
Hello, Maggie. Listen, what he says, this is what he does. I talk about Trump. He says, I like uneducated people because those people do not know how to check their references. They do not know that they don't have a skill. They don't have a habit. Because it's a smart thing to do that even if you, and I trust you with everything you said, but I would want to know the whole story. You have a minute to say snapshots of the fact, snapshots of the historical factors. Go, if you are educated, right, then go and actually look and be more educated. But
I couldn't agree with you more, Karina. We do our best given the limited time we've got. But I'll just say this. I'll disagree with you slightly. Yes, Donald Trump says he likes it when people are lemmings, basically. That's what I don't think it's about educated, not educated, smart, not smart. I don't know the difference between that. I know plenty of folks that don't have a college degree that are way smarter than I am. I think the piece that I really agree with Karina about is that it takes effort. Feelings aren't facts. And when people are manipulating your feelings and they're not supporting them with cited facts that you can check, be wary. I just want us all to be better consumers of information and political rhetoric. Because listen, there is rhetoric. We employ rhetorical devices. I do myself on the show. But that's why I try to take such care to give you the underlying factual information so that you can go check it. And if I get it wrong, I'll tell you that. And all of this stuff, it matters. It's not just rhetoric for rhetoric's sake. Transgender youth are the most likely to commit suicide. 24% of transgender adults have now reported that they've had their healthcare disrupted or discontinued by the spate of anti-transgender legislation. Can you imagine that? You want to get your Viagra. You want to get your breast enlargement. You want to access good antidepressants. And someone passes a law that says, no, you can't. Why? Because I have a different religious belief. I believe erectile dysfunction medication, breast enlargements, and antidepressants are against my religion. And I'm going to declare my religion the best religion. And now you can't get the healthcare that you want. It's not American. It's not moral. And it sure as heck ain't legal.
I'll tack on that some of the research out of the Institute for Sexual Wellness was about how providing this kind of care was decreasing the number of suicides that they saw in the trans community back then. But we don't have all that paperwork anymore because the Nazis burned it. Reiterate what was said. Yeah, exactly.
Book bans of today are the Nazi book burning of yesterday. It just ain't that complicated. Moms for Liberty quoted some Nazi stuff on one of their journal articles or newsletters. And it doesn't stop there, right? We've got a serial liar megalomaniac running for president. Okay, we've got two serial liar megalomaniacs running for president. One of them's named Donald Trump. The other one is named Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And who did he pick for his running mate? Another megalomaniac, rich person, serial liar. I'm going to talk more about that when we come back, because the Washington Post fact-checked the heck out of RFK's newly announced running mate. We'll get into that because today's episode is about debunking the lies. My show, in large part, is about debunking the lies, helping us all become better informed voters and citizens, and calling out the things that are just so un-American as to defy explanation and logic. I'm Maggie Dawn. She's Anya Esther. You're not going to want to miss our last segment on this Thursday. If you want to get in on the conversation for our last bit of the show, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. Back with more in just a moment. Now how are we to live in a world like this? Greedy politicians, present and past, they wouldn't know the truth.
Keep on running because the winner don't quit on themselves.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show. We got our last segment of the day. If you want to get in on the action, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. We have a pathological narcissist, megalomaniac, liar running for president. Oh, and there's another one running for president, and his name is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He recently announced that he picked Nicole Shanahan as his vice president. And boy, she's a real peach. Very rich. And said some things very recently that were just shocking to me. There's a lot of nonsense that she said. This was in Oakland, California. She talked toxic substances in our environment, like endocrine disrupting chemicals. She goes on about it. Electromagnetic pollution. Okay. And then she says, oh, and our own medications. Pharmaceutical medicine has its place, but no single safety study can assess the cumulative impact of one prescription on top of another prescription and one shot on top of another shot on top of another shot throughout the course of childhood. We just don't do that study right now, and we ought to. More on that in a moment. We can and we will. Conditions like autism used to be 1 in 10,000. Now here in the state of California, it's 1 in 22. So basically, she's trotting out this old saw that childhood vaccinations cause autism. Let's investigate, shall we? You know, if she can't fact check and educate herself despite having hundreds of millions of dollars, we'll do it for her here on the Maggie Dawn Show. As the Washington Post pointed out, this entire anti-vax garbage movement started with an article that came out in The Lancet in 1998. by a guy by the name of Andrew Wakefield. Now, The Lancet is one of the world's most respected medical journals. It was a peer-reviewed article. And it suggested a link between childhood vaccinations and autism. And it absolutely rocked the medical community. But here's what. After it came out, it was completely debunked. And Wakefield ended up losing his medical license. Okay? Here's what. That study, quote unquote study, was based on a supposedly random sample of 12 kids. Oops. 12 does not equal statistical significance. I'm an economist. I can tell you that. You can take that one to the bank. 12 samples does not equal statistical significance. But the entire study was bogus. Not only was it a ridiculously, stupidly narrow sample, he was secretly paid by a lawyer who was hoping to sue vaccine manufacturers. And Wakefield himself had applied for his own measles, mumps, and rubella alternative vaccine. And he had doctored the data and doctored the patient records. So it was completely bogus. And again, the guy lost his medical license. Now, it took 12 years for all of this correction to happen. And that was the problem. The misinformation was already out there. And a vice presidential candidate is still spewing this nonsense over 25 years later. That's the problem with misinformation, energized, engaged in, amplified, replicated now by social media. By the way, every single major study that has come out since that bogus, bought and paid for junk science, made up data article in 1998 has shown no link at all. This includes, of course, one massive study that involved 1.8 million children tracked over 14 years. 1.8 million kids tracked over 14 years. There is no link between childhood vaccines and autism. I mean, most of the other stuff she said was also misstated, total garbage. You can check out the Washington Post article that came out this morning, written by Glenn Kessler, titled RF Kennedy Jr.'s Running Mate and the Vaccine Wars. But here's the other thing that's been bothering me a lot lately. And it's a version of lying. And it's the lies that come out in polls. The Wall Street Journal recently put out a poll that showed Biden trailing in all the swing states. It's garbage. It's garbage. And again, scares people, tries to build momentum for Trump. It's garbage for two reasons. 99% of the polls were conducted in English, not Spanish. Other studies have showed that when you poll Latino voters, if you do it only in English, it skews way Republican. The other thing is that one of the guys that worked on the poll is a dude by the name of Tony Fabrizio. He worked on Trump's 2020 campaign. What do you think that poll is going to say, huh? Now, a liberal leading firm was also involved in the poll, but we don't really know what happened there. And again, Rupert Murdoch, serial liar endorser on Fox News related to election misinformation and lies, he owns the Wall Street Journal. And by the way, the poll came out basically at the same time Fabrizio said he was rejoining the Trump campaign as a senior advisor. And who is this Fabrizio guy? If it's ringing a faint bell. Oh, yeah. It's him and his firm is the one that gave the polling data to the Russians at the request of Paul Manafort. Yeah, that's why he's familiar. And that he ended up actually getting subpoenaed and questioned by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller because of his involvement. So not really reliable. I'll say all of that to say, don't believe the polls unless they're truly independent. And very few of them are, because Donald Trump lost 120,000 votes in Tuesday's primary to a candidate that ain't the nominee. I think that bodes well for all of us. I'm Maggie Dawn. That's it for this Thursday edition of the Maggie Dawn Show. Stay put, because the devil's advocate's hours, 4 to 6 p.m. coming up.